This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 180, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. And you can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free, along with over 170 hours of extended episodes on Patreon. This week, I'm talking to Joshua Cutchin about his book, Fourth Wall Phantoms, Reflections on the Paranormal, Narrative, and Fictions Becoming Fact. Joshua has appeared on hundreds of paranormal programs, including Coast to Coast AM, and is regularly invited to speak at paranormal conferences about his work. In addition to his own books, Joshua also regularly contributes to essay collections, most recently Dr. Jack Hunter's Deep Weird and Dr. Simon Young's The Cottingley Fairies. He has appeared on Ancient Aliens and was featured in the UFO documentary Cosmosis. Hi Joshua, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thanks very much for having me today. I'm looking forward to it.
We're going to talk about your book. It's called Fourth Wall Phantoms, Reflections on the Paranormal, Narrative, and Fictions Becoming Fact. I wanted to start off just by asking you about this little story you tell at the beginning of the book with Canella and Donald Duck. So what happens there, and how is this an example of what you're talking about?
Right. We're just jumping right in the deep end, aren't we? Well, this is a story that I found, credit where credit is due, on Lon Strickler's Phantoms and Monsters website, and it'll be pretty evident why stories like this don't get a lot of attention otherwise. There was a witness who was named Canella, and she claims in a memory from when she was 4 years old in 1978 that she has these vivid memories of being in a room with Donald Duck, like the cartoon character Donald Duck, and they would play together, and this character's disposition seemed to switch on a dime for whatever reason, and Canella was very terrified, as I would be if Donald Duck was mad at me in my bedroom, and tried to reach the doorknob, but you know, being a toddler, she wasn't able to quite reach it, and she screamed for her mother, and her mother came in and opens the door, and of course there's nothing there. But this is a good example of sort of what forms it's either the core or it's the first step of Fourth Wall Phantoms, right? It's this idea of fictional incursions, which that's my term for this idea of either just fictions in general bleeding into reality or specifically characters from fiction bleeding into reality. And these ideas are not taken seriously at all by many researchers, and for obvious reasons. I mean, I don't like these stories either, right? They make me kind of uncomfortable. They are the fringe of the fringe. But, you know, as with a lot of my other work, the fact that I don't want to look at it suggests to me that I should look at it. And so what happened from there was this journey, taking a look at how not only we have these examples, and there are plenty, that rabbit hole goes a lot deeper than I thought it did. So we can maybe put a pin in that and come back to it if you want to. But not only are these examples of characters stepping off the page or stepping out of the screens into our lives, but also the way that all paranormal topics, by which I mean not only parapsychology, ghosts, but also cryptozoology and ufology. I know some people don't put those in there, but all paranormal topics seem to have this dialogue with our culture and with our media, and how the phenomenon itself seems to appropriate aspects from our fictions into real life sightings.
And there's a thing there where she's a child and Donald Duck is a children's character. So is there a thing that there was something there, and maybe they picked something to present to her that she'd be comfortable with? Or maybe that whatever's there, she co-created. It's like she imprinted upon it an image.
Yeah, I'm of multiple minds about this, because you're not... You're not having four-year-old children seeing John Rambo, you know, or some other violent action star or action character. You're seeing them, you know. I have stories in the book from Sesame Street characters to obviously cartoon characters, things like Alice in Wonderland, comic book characters, things like that. So it does seem to be age-appropriate material in most cases. And that does ask a big question about how much we bring to these experiences. I am sympathetic and aware of the conventional explanation that a lot of ufologists use, that these are screen memories. And, you know, I I'm only critical of that idea because I like to sort of be a contrarian sometimes. But I still think that the idea of screen memory is pretty ill-defined. Is it tech? Is it telepathic powers? Like, what is it and why is it, you know? And I think that those questions are still very much up for debate. Obviously, it looks a bit like fairy folklore. And a lot of my work centers around the similarities between fairies and UFO occupants. But, you know, it's funny, Simon, people have been throwing around this term ontological shock a lot lately from the late John Mack. And they've been using that to reference, the UFO/UAP disclosures that we're having as being an example of ontological shock. Kind of, but for me, like, the actual ontological shock would be that reality can warp so bizarrely that ideas can take form and step off the page. Now, what is that? Is it a tulpa? Is it an egregore? Is it co-created? I mean, you know, I'm sympathetic to those ideas, but, you know, I have some problems with them. The idea of the tulpa, idea of a thought form, is often sort of trotted out as this sort of mystical Eastern tradition, but I'm not sure how much evidence there is for that. I mean, there are similar ideas, yeah, but like the way that the idea of the tulpa was presented in the work of Alexander David Neil as some sort of, you know, long lost Eastern secret, I don't think is quite accurate. It seems to be more a culturally appropriated reinvention from theosophy, right? I mean, there are bits and pieces of this idea. At the same time, I'm convinced that things like that can happen, where sufficient thought and focus and determination can manifest, a being from one's imagination. The idea of the egregore is similar, although that generally is things more like, you know, broad and sweeping ideas, almost a little bit more archetypal. So you get things like St. George in England, or you get things like, the White House, like these sort of like broad sort of, you know, broader categories. And again, there's something to that. You know, I think that there are these entities that exist as ideas, but I really am fascinated by this idea that ideas have agency. You know, there's this quote that's attributed apocryphally to Carl Jung that people don't have ideas, ideas have people. And whether or not he actually said that, it's consistent with some of the things that he said over his lifetime. But B, I think it's a really interesting concept, the idea that there is not only an ontology, an objectivity, an objective reality to our ideas and thoughts and imagination, but there's also autonomy and agency on the other side of that. So to that extent, I do think it is, as you alluded to in your initial question, co-creative, right? You know, it's always so funny to me. Whenever I write a book, I get so proud of myself, like, oh, I've come up with this idea and that idea. And then I reread John Keel and I'm like, oh yeah, I kind of just was reworking this idea of John Keel's. And it's interesting that co-creative aspect has sort of been wending its way through a lot of John Keel's work. The idea that, yes, there is an intelligence there in these experiences. There is an intelligence that is either not us or part of us, but detached, whatever. But like, there is something there. There's a there. But the exact parameters by which it appears to us and the stimuli that we get are somehow provided by ourselves, either subconsciously or you know, the thing itself that we're observing somehow reaches into our mind and flips through the Rolodex of thoughts and images and influences and says, oh, today I'm going to look like a Bigfoot, or, oh, today I'm a leprechaun, or, you know, last time I was a UFO, today I'll be a lake monster, you know, something like that. You know, I personally suspect that that might have something to do with the anomalous light phenomena that we see in a lot of these encounters. Like that's kind of the glue that holds all the paranormal together, right? The lights are everywhere, these light phenomena. And, you know, maybe that's what the paranormal intelligences look like when they are sort of stripped of cultural expectation and, you know, personal baggage and beliefs and whatnot. So yeah, it's a lot of different directions that you can take this. And this is before sort of even getting into some of the more esoteric and philosophical elements.
So if it's being co-created with something, who or what are we co-creating with? Is it a trickster? Is it God? Is it the universe?
I mean, it's kind of funny, Simon. I think that people will probably look across my corpus, if I may be so pretentious as to say that, and say that I'm shockingly inconsistent with my views, but like, you know, I'm just sort of Goldilocksing my way through this, just like everyone else. And I kind of tend to treat a lot of my works as sort of standalone concepts. So as far as what that is, other than that, there's something there. I would say that there's something there that at least, at the very least, appears to be independent from us. Is sort of like the as far as I'll go, right? I mean, I'm obviously very sympathetic to the idea that there is sort of a robust spirit ecosystem that's out there. You know, my last nonfiction book before this was Ecology of Souls, my two-parter about death and the paranormal. And I think that, you know, if you held a gun to my head, I might say that it's all spirits, right? But at the same time, you know, a lot of the places that I went with Fourth Wall Phantoms is into this realm of archetypes and the imaginal, and which seems much more collective and much more, at the very least, you know, in sort of a call and response with the human nature, if not directly coming from us, you know, during these experiences. And at the same time, you know, I'm working on another book with my friend Barbara Fisher right now that mostly focuses around the idea that, as I alluded to earlier, it is those lights that is the natural form of this thing, perhaps intelligent plasmas that then, you know, there's an argument to be made that the light from the plasmas somehow interacts with your pineal gland, which has obviously, you know, possibly some role in producing DMT, which perhaps an endogenous flood of DMT, you know, floods your system. And that's why the light looks like something else. I don't know. You know, you can make up a scenario. But, you know, I suspect it might be the lights. But I really don't know. Like, I really don't know at the end of the day. I mean, you know, it may be the malevolent elder gods, or it may be just as it appears, and I am completely wrong. You know, we are dealing with extraterrestrials with UFOs. We are dealing with dead people with ghosts, and we are dealing with, you know, undiscovered animals with cryptids. I suspect that's not the case, but, you know, I have to remain open to that. So I think the jury is still out in that regard.
Do you feel that people have these experiences more often than we think? Because I suppose people were worried they'll be thought of as crazy if they say they saw a UFO, but if they say Donald Duck came to visit, they're more a Chewbacca.
Right. I make this allusion, or this the statement in the beginning of the book that, you know, these cases aren't in the garbage. They're in the landfill. Like, they're already out of the house. Get them out of the house. They stink to high heaven. Nobody wants to talk to them. I really do suspect that. And that's not even necessarily based on my research. It's based on the work of others. You know, there's a great book that every time you work on a project like this, oftentimes you will encounter a work that predates yours that you kind of wish you could just copy paste into your book. Not in the sense of plagiarizing it, but in the sense of like making sure that everyone who's reading your book has read this book. And that one in particular is Chidambaram Ramesh's Embodied Imaginations, which goes through a rather shocking litany of people who have had these sort of experiences. You know, this seems to be a phenomenon that's much more pronounced with creative types, by which I mean not the consumers of art, but the creators of these characters. But you can find examples from Balzac, Didion, Proust, Milton, Blake, Shelley, Kipling, Keats, George Sand, Nietzsche. I mean, they're all these, like, you know, who's another one? Dickens talked about this sort of phenomenon some. Alice Walker, you know, who wrote The Color Purple, all had varying degrees of interactions with their characters, you know. And that goes from everything from, you know, just a sense that they have some sort of agency in their writing to literally, like, seeing or touching or being touched by their characters. There's a famous story where Nora from Doll's House interacts with Heinrich Ibsen during the writing of that. So just bizarre. And it sounds like completely goofy, but this is just something that we haven't really accepted as paranormalists. And I think it might be kind of the next frontier. There was a study that I cited in Fourth Wall Phantoms of a survey from Durham University in 2018 and 2014. They went to Edinburgh International Book Festival and asked them, like, how often do you have interactions with your characters? And they had a sample size of a little bit over 180, I think, participants. And 63% claimed that they could hear their characters speak while they were writing. 61% of the authors said that the characters were capable of acting independently. And then 56% of the writers said that they had visual or other sensory experiences of their characters. And another 15% like had embodied conversations with their characters. So it's actually, I was surprised at how often this seems to happen. Now, you know, we can make a lot of, this is where I think the Tolpa argument falls down a bit, right? Even though Alexander David Neil said that the monk that she created in Tibet gained its sort of own agency and was appearing to other people. But at the same time, like, we can, the Tolpa thing fits really well onto creative people who are obsessing over their characters, seeing their characters, right? That we can have, we have some sort of esoteric template for that. It gets really strange when you have people who are consumers of media who see these characters, and even stranger still when they are consumers of media who aren't necessarily even fans of the media until they later see something like, oh, it looks just like that. Like, there's an example of an UFO experiencer that corresponded with Ann and Whitley Strieber, who had experiences with this little critter with a hood and these glowing eyes. And it wasn't until years later that she saw Star Wars and said, oh, that looks exactly, like, literally to a T, exactly like what I saw. And so, like, is that a runaway tulpa? I don't know, maybe. Or that idea has some sort of autonomy to it and sort of exists on its own in some sort of intermediate state between fiction and reality.
Because you talk in the book about people seeing John Constantine.
Yeah. I don't know what it is about Constantine that makes him such prime material for these sort of manifestations. But yeah, there's multiple explanations that are actually fairly well attested. So yeah, Constantine was created by Alan Moore for an issue of Swamp Thing. He based his appearance off of Sting, musician, and it's an occult detective. And one of the most famous examples of a fictional incursion was Alan Moore being in a sandwich shop in Westminster and seeing this character walk in. You know, in the interview that where Alan Moore's talking about this, he says he looked like Sting. Actually, he didn't look like Sting. He looked like Constantine. And they shared sort of a knowing look, but he just decided to not talk with him. And what's interesting is that other people who have seen Constantine, because there are a lot of them, have had this exact same experience where they're like, should I talk to him? Maybe I won't. But, you know, in the 1980s, Jamie Delano had sort of this running commentary with Constantine, and that sort of came to a head when he was out on the streets, when he actually had a visible physical manifestation of Constantine. He was walking by the British Museum, and the two of them looked at each other, and Constantine, you know, flicks his ash from his cigarette and goes around the corner. And again, he had this moment was like, should I follow him and say something? But the idea was no. Brian Azzarello also worked on the comic in the 2000s and saw Constantine and in a Chicago bar, didn't say anything to him, avoided him. There was someone else I'm trying to remember, Peter Milligan, who also saw a character that looked like Constantine at a party. He, ran out of the party. And this time the witness followed and there was nobody there. So this happens again and again. And even my editor and friend, Barbara Fisher, claims to have had an experience with Constantine where, again, she saw, you get the story, the impression it's almost like Constantine was undercover. But, you know, she got this impression like, this is not somebody I should talk to. And, you know, she was planning on using Constantine in some fan fiction that she was writing. So there are a lot of questions. You know, it's a little bit difficult with some of these human characters who are fictional incursions, because, like, there's always the chance that it's a costume, you know, cosplayer, or that, you know, it's just somebody who bears a resemblance to that character. It gets a little bit more difficult to explain away when you've got, like, monsters and things that first originated in fiction popping up into our lifestyles, into our lives. But it's a very common thing, and it just, honestly, so much of this book leaves me scratching my head more than anything else.
Walter B. Gibson and the Shadow Hauntings.
Yes.
That seemed like maybe a thought form or something.
Yeah, I don't know what to make of it either, but this is, you know, after, or maybe it's tied with the Alan Moore stuff as the most famous fictional incursion. But yeah, Walter B. Gibson was just a prolific writer of this character called the Shadow. Wrote like 300 novels involving this crime-fighting character, Lamont Cranston. There was a film starring Alec Baldwin, I think, from the 90s. That was an adaptation of it. But, you know, The Shadow was also a very famous radio serial. So, like, you can't really overstate how popular this character was. But for a while, Gibson was writing those novels and obviously focusing a lot on this character at an apartment in Greenwich Village. It wasn't until long after he'd moved out that Hans Holzer, famous, you know, parapsychologist, was detailing stories, claims of a haunting at this particular apartment in New York. And one of the things that a guest to the home had seen was a dark-haired figure with evening clothes and an Inverness cape. And, the second time she saw it, it was a large, wide-brimmed hat. And, you know, this was just, as most ghost hunters would do, like, they're like, well, who here possibly died that fits that description? Like, those very quaint and conventional lines of exploration. But it wasn't until later that Gibson was giving a magazine interview, a lot like Alan Moore and John Constantine, now that I think about it, because that also came out in a magazine interview. But, Gibson was giving this interview and alluded to the fact that, I heard that Hans Holzer said that people were seeing this character in my old apartment, and it's not a ghost. It's the Shadow. He called it a psychic projection rather than a ghost. And that's sort of like one of the most famous versions of this fictional incursion idea. It was brought to light by John Keel in one of his books, and is sort of like a real, really classic case study in this phenomenon.
So it was like he was in the apartment writing 10,000 words a day. All that was in his mind was this character, and he wrote so many books. It's like he created a thought form that then other people could see after he left.
Yeah, but I kind of have to question first principles. I'm like, yes, 100%, that is an interpretation, right? But another interpretation was that something came to him while he was staying in that apartment and, possessed him in that sort of creative sense. That if you're creative, you know, definitely know what that feels like. But something possessed him, something came to him, an idea came to him in that space and sort of moved into him and moved into the space. And, you know, the experience was so strong that it just sort of lingered after he'd left. Like, I'm not sure, it's a chicken or the egg sort of question, which is, you know, where I sort of, not to wade too early into the ufological material, but, you know, this is something that forms a lot of the basis for my chapter on UFOs. There are some explicit examples of fictional incursions in conventional UFO sightings, but even on a more subtle level, it's very clear that fictions have influenced sightings as well. Now, to be clear, I'm not saying that people aren't experiencing these things. I'm not saying that the phenomenon isn't real. I'm just saying that there's like this dialogue, this call and response, this reciprocity between the phenomenon and our media. And this is something that was noted by Bertrand Mayeust, a French scholar who was noting back in the 70s that it was very clear that some examples of experiences were reporting from their contacts, like inside the craft and stuff, had clear antecedents in some of the early sci-fi pulps, right? Things like, you know, the nondescript illumination, for example, on the interior of the craft, or the circular round room, right? And I agree with that. That seems to be a very clear connection there. At the same time, I have to acknowledge the fact that things like the indirect illumination and the round room, like, are prefigured in other things that seem to have a lot to do with UFO contact, like shamanic initiations, like trips to fairyland. Like, these are things that you also see in that as well. So which came first, the chicken or the egg, or the fiction or the fact, right? And then somebody else, I'm sure, would say, well, the examples from Fairyland and from shamanic initiation, like, those are prefigured in the stories of these indigenous communities. And it's like, well, okay, now we're back to, you know, in some people's view, fictions, or at least stories, right? And I think you can keep on doing that back and back and back and back and back and back and forth until you wind up at something like petroglyphs, where it's like, well, what is this? Is this art? Is this, you know, an objective depiction of reality? And I think it's probably somewhere in between, you know? I really don't know what to make of it. I think the best thing you can do is just sort of try to be as open with either possibility as you can. But it does seem to me like there's some sort of interplay between expectation, culture, art, and the phenomenon.
It's like you're saying, those shapes of the craft appear to be based in the era that they're seen. If we go back, like the 1890s, and people seeing those steampunk airships.
Yeah, I found this kind of fascinating, and I feel a little bit vindicated, although I should have been a little bit more public about my prediction. So let me explain. So you've got, as you said, you know, the steampunk airships that happened in the early 20th century. You know, the Arnold era, we get sort of more Art Nouveau flying, or Art Nouveau sort of flying saucers. And then in the 70s and 80s, we start seeing more of these black triangles, which certainly speak to, like, you know, stealth technology that was emerging at the time. And, you know, I've been saying ever since the Tic Tac footage, which was released, which, again, like, has been forced down our throats as a community, as a, even if you're not into UFOs, like, you've seen that footage, right? And tic tac, tic tac, tic tac, tic tac, and it's a drone like formation, right? And so I said privately to some friends, I said, you know, I think the next form that the UFO is going to take is going to be, you know, the form of a drone. And, you know, one of my friends was like, oh, but yeah, people haven't been really reporting drone aircraft. And I was like, well, you know, you're right, but I feel like that's the next step. And boy, oh boy, you know, December of 2024 came along, and everyone was seeing Everyone was seeing drones here in the U.S., especially in the eastern U.S. And, you know, I think I don't really know what that drone flap was. I think that a lot of it was terrestrial. I think that a lot of people were looking into the sky for the first time, which means that with that, you got a lot of misidentification. You got a lot of people probably seeing genuine anomalies, right? Because they're actually looking in the sky for the first time. But the point that I'm making is that in the public's mind, there was a certain level of synonymity between UFOs and drones. And that was the sea change that I was expecting, you know? And that's what the phenomenon seems to do. The UFO phenomenon is, it seems to be very good about updating its software from time to time. You know, you could argue that angels and demons sort of turned into fairies and then turned into, you know, space brothers and then turned into to the grays. Like, I think there's a strong argument to be made for that. And just as, you know, the craft seem to make these updates too. I think that I have a suspicion, again, I'm not much of a field researcher. I do more than I used to, for sure. But, you know, I'm not taking, you know, multiple firsthand accounts every year. But I do know from some of my friends who have been in that space that it seems like the, you know, UFO contact experience has sort of changed in its flavor and its character. It seems to be less about these abductions and surgical procedures and things like that, and more about downloads and consciousness travels, if you will, and things like that, more in line of the ecstatic sort of vision tradition. So I think that we're sort of in some regards an exciting time, that, you know, the phenomenon may have put in some effort into changing the way it appears to us for the first time in, you know, a good, what, 40 or 50 years.
And if it is changing over time, I mean, over centuries, what's the end game? Why change? Why bring all this weirdness into our lives?
Right. The thing that I'm afraid of is that, you know, we're going to replace the aliens with, you know, AI bots. Like, that's the next mask that the phenomenon's going to choose, right? And it won't be It won't be, the aliens took me aboard their spaceship and harvested my gametes. It's going to be, the AI bots came and drug me to their subterranean server farm to download my consciousness or something like that. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if that's what happens. I don't know, Simon, if there is an end game. Because as I'm saying, I'm giving a level of agency to the phenomenon that I'm not sure is necessarily in its hands. Like, it might be us, as you alluded to earlier with the co-creation idea, it might be us forcing the phenomena into these different shapes and modalities. So as long as we don't have an end game, it won't have an end game, I suppose, which is the real question that kind of, you know, keeps me up at night is where are human beings headed? You know, I'm not sure, you know, I really am not sure, but I think that that's an excellent question. I love that question.
I had a close-up UFO sighting. The UFO was about 25 feet off the ground and 200 feet from me. Didn't move an inch the whole time, was completely silent, shaped like a rugby ball. Typical UFO in a way. And I was driving past and I was looking up at it from my windscreen. And I thought afterwards, maybe I saw it because they wanted me to see it. And this idea that we're all on a path, and I might call it a spiritual path, and they presented themselves to move me another step down the path. Because you say in the book, for all we know, UFOs are nothing more than plot devices meant to push us forward through our lives.
Yeah. I mean, I think that you're onto something there. I think that there's a certain amount of theatricality that's embedded in the phenomenon. That was certainly Mayust's assessment. But, you know, I had this moment, I didn't really include this in the book, but that's sort of what I was driving at in that sense. There's a quote by Ami Michel, French ufologist, who said that, you know, UFO field work is strange because you start out looking at sightings of craft in the sky and you end up reading about Sufi mystics, right? So I think that's a great quote in the sense that it really does capture the journey that a lot of ourselves find ourselves on. And, I remember distinctly, this is the anecdote that I didn't include in the book, but I probably could have. My sons were on a field trip to a children's museum, and I was staring at some exhibit. I think it was probably a geology exhibit, you know, something that I don't really find particularly compelling. But, you know, if you do, then more power to you. You know, it's just never been my thing. I was staring at it, and something that I saw in that exhibit, exactly what it was is inconsequential, but something that I saw in the exhibit spoke to something, reminded me of something else, reminded me of that had to do with UFOs. And it made the geology exhibit, which I didn't really find that entertaining or interesting again. And it sort of re-enchanted the world in that respect. And, you know, that does lead me to wonder in some of my more introspective moments as to whether or not, you know, the point of the UFO is to facilitate that sort of reflection and sort of re-enchantment and that sort of alchemical process of learning about things. I mean, like, you know, I would never have learned about panpsychism or idealism or dual aspect monism if it wasn't for UFOs. You know what I'm saying? So I think that sometimes, you know, I can't guarantee that there is a there behind the UFO, but I do know that there's a there here, you know, sitting with me in front of the computer right now. And I kind of wonder if that is not what the purpose of the UFO is to act as a driver, as a catalyst for that greater understanding and to really bring us back into connection with how miraculous the world is.
I wanted to ask you about a weird story in your book. You could say they're all weird stories in your book. Lev Lebedev and the UFO on TV. That was really strange.
I mean, yeah, so that's my ulterior motive for writing this book, right? Because like I'm a bit like a junkie and I need my next high, and you know, I'm tired of like the basic encounter scenarios, and like I'm always looking for that next, let's make the strangeness higher, right? Higher, yeah. Strangeness, higher strangeness, because I just adore high strangeness stories. And this one definitely scratches that itch. And I'm like, well, I'm going to gather all these together in one place for fellow weirdos like me who want to hear the really strange stuff. It was a story from the mid-90s or early mid-90s. And there was an artist by the name of Lev Alexandrovich Lebedev, who was, towards the Kamchatka side of Russia. And he was sleeping on his couch, and wakes up because he's hearing this buzzing sound on the TV, but the TV's unplugged. And on the TV is a image of a UFO, you know, classic saucer shape. And he's like, where is this? And he looks outside his window and he sees it, you know, flying above the bay. And he looks back to the TV, and then he gets this like parade of images of these sort of, I guess, you know, in modern UFO parlance, you might call them Nordics or, you know, Space Brothers in the older terms, but who were just like showing him these images and, you know, images of syringes and sort of ending with sort of a weird, like almost Christ-like figure with these fiery glowing eyes. And then the UFO pops back on the screen and the TV dies. And he's like, okay, this is weird, right? And the next night he can't sleep, and he wakes up and the TV that's unplugged is back on again, showing him more of these images and, you know, images of the television and images of their home world and images, you know, some mystic sort of imagery. And then they tell him, okay, that's it, we're done, bye. And then they just never enter his life again, which is really odd, but it's a good example of, like, you know, I use that in the book of being like, well, were these things on the TV or were they in the TV? You know? And obviously the TV was unplugged, so I'm not even really entertaining. I'm asking that question more metaphorically, right? Because, you know, you do have that sort of literal fourth wall break of the UFO on screen versus the UFO, you know, in the sky. Where does reality end and fiction begin is part of the question. Maybe I should define fourth wall breaks. We've been talking about fourth wall phantoms all this time. The reason the book is called Fourth Wall Phantoms is because in the theater, and it's since been used in cinema, there was a concept that there is an invisible fourth wall between the actors / characters and the audience. So the three walls of the proscenium and whatnot, and then the fourth wall is invisible. It's between the actors and the audience. And whenever the characters acknowledge the audience, then that is a fourth wall break. And we see this in media all the time now. You know, characters like Deadpool, one of my favorite comedy shows of all time, Arrested Development. There were a lot of fourth wall breaks in that as well. But the term that, you know, narratologists actually use is this term called metalepsis. The reason that they use that is because, you know, we think of fourth wall breaks as just being like characters talking to the camera or the audience, but really the idea of metalepsis is quite complex. And it can be narrators interacting with characters, or vice versa, you know, crossover events, multimedia sort of events, characters interacting with the audience, or, you know, any sort of interactive media. Like, I think Black Mirror a few years ago had this sort of like choose your own adventure style episode on Netflix. That would be an example of metalepsis. And there's a bunch of scholarship on that. And, that's where the term fourth wall phantoms comes from. And, over the course of writing this book, I sort of found personally that metalepsis was a really excellent metaphor for sort of talking about the boundary transgression that happens when people encounter the paranormal.
Have you heard about many people who see maybe Star Wars ships in the sky or meet with Star Wars creatures or Star Trek things? You see stuff coming through from all over media.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of this, it becomes this like infinite data set, right? Because, you know, the number of UFO accounts that we don't even apprehend as being influenced by fiction seem to be influenced by fiction. A classic example of this is the electronics or, you know, motor interference that we see in a lot of UFO cases. You know, that's become a sort of trope of a UFO. I saw a UFO and my car engine died or my lights went out, you know, those sort of things. And, you know, one of my personal hero scholars, Martin Kottmeyer, has been interested in this topic for, you know, decades. And he has found that the first example of that that trope of UFOs or, you know, extraplanetary craft interfering with electronics actually originates in, again, some of those early old pulps, you know, and they seem to predate some of the earliest stories of engine malfunction by a few decades themselves. So it's even little things like that, you could make an argument, are sort of fictional incursions, or they're at least examples of fiction influencing the phenomenon. Again, to be clear, I feel like I have to say this a lot. To be clear, I'm not saying that people are making this up. I'm saying, like, there's this call and response. The phenomenon is really interested in the way that in how we think of it, and kind of like almost like an eager child wants to live up to our expectations. And so there are tons of little examples like that as well. But then there are some more overt examples, like you mentioned. I mean, people have seen, if you can believe it, you know, X-Wings and the Millennium Falcon and you know, the Death Star in the sky during UFO sightings. You know, even if that's their only point of comparison, they might say it seemed very similar to, but some of them will say it looked just like XYZ. You know, sometimes you sort of have to read around the lines. There was a case that I found of a Ukrainian witness who was taking soil samples at Chernobyl, and said that this globe sort of landed on the ground in front of her, I believe. And this very handsome being, looked like a human being, with a beard and half black, half red uniform with a triangle symbol on its chest, used a device in his hands to stun her. I'm like, oh, it was William Riker. Like, it was William Riker from The Next Generation, you know, handsome, black and red uniform, triangle emblem, stunning her, you know. So, like, you know, how many of those slip through the cracks because we're not looking for it in that direction, because we're so afraid as researchers and authors that, oh, this looks exactly like fiction XYZ is going to discredit the account. And what I'm saying is, like, what happens if we just, like, entertain the possibility, you know, that an account resembling fiction does not instantly discredit it, and that in fact it might actually be support for the account actually having happened. You know, one of the things that I'm at pains to say throughout the book is that I think a lot of us could benefit from sort of having a system that is a little bit more like, you know, instead of having this binary that we sort everything into in our heads, we say, okay, well, you know, I have a basket in my head that says true and it's pretty small. And I have a basket in my head that says false and it's pretty small. But the basket in my head that says interesting if true is gigantic. And that's where most things wind up. Small true basket, small false basket, gigantic interesting if true basket. And, you know, just to not feel like we have to settle on, oh, this story is crap or this story is authentic, or, you know, just be like, wow, that's an interesting story. Don't really know what to do with it. I'll try to remember some of these details for the future.
And there are cases there then where people, they would have seen Star Wars, and so they see something from Star Wars in the sky, perhaps. So that's after they've seen the film. But I think you have a couple of cases in the book where they see something, they have an experience, and then later it appears in fiction.
Right. Well, you know, there was that example of the Jawas that I mentioned, but, you know, another good example that comes to mind instantly is this, you know, there was a case from July of 1961 in the Isle of Wight. Mrs. Smith saw a UFO and she drew a sketch of it, and it looked exactly like an Adamski scout ship, you know, the George Adamski scout ships. She claimed, the researchers were like, you know what this looks like? And she's like, no, what does this look like? And they said, you know, they showed her the photos of that Adamski had supposedly taken, and they were more or less a perfect match. And yet, you know, Adamski's images were hoaxes. Like, I think we can all pretty much agree on that. So, you know, that's another good example of somebody interacting with a form that they weren't exposed to prior. Because you're absolutely right. Like, a lot of these things come in the form of comparisons. Like, they see something that says, oh, it looked like exactly like media XYZ. But there are a couple of examples throughout the book where people sort of realize something after the fact that they hadn't been exposed to at the time. They said, oh, it looks like this. So, you know, the Adamski example is also, I think, really indicative of how hoaxes also play a role in the paranormal, because hoaxes are fictions, right? And yet they seem to have this ability to coax out genuine phenomenon. And this is not my observation. This is something that This is something that was, you know, first noticed by George P. Hansen in his book, The Trickster and the Paranormal, that, you know, there's something about appeasing the imagination that allows the imaginal, that allows the world of spirit or the paranormal or whatever. There's something about appeasing the imagination, providing that suspension of disbelief that allows this genuine anomaly to sweep in and sort of fill that space in between and to facilitate genuine strangeness occurring. That's another example of that too. And I think that, you know, if we're talking about suspensions of disbelief and stuff like that, that's what, you know, cinema is all about. And books are all about to a certain degree as well, although it's easier to accommodate things in your head, but that's certainly what cinema is all about. So, you know, I think that we ignore these correlations or we ignore these data points at our peril in the paranormal, because I think there is something to learn from it, even if we shouldn't take every story as completely true on face value.
What about the shape of the greys? Because I hear a lot of, like, they're different sizes and they might look slightly different sometimes. Do you think the greys appeared perhaps in the 90s and then they became a social thing people were aware of, and so that's what people started to see when they're having a genuine encounter?
Right. Well, you know, I get very tired of people who point to the cover of Communion and saying that was the flashpoint for the greys, because Communion was, you know, what, 86, 87? And, you know, Close Encounters of the Third Kind was 77. And that's obviously got that classic grey, you know, in that film as well. And yeah, you know, there are some people who would point to that as sort of being a major influence. And certainly, you know, people started seeing the gray alien more and more. Although even in the modern day, I would argue that probably the appearance of the grays in a lot of these scenarios is perhaps overstated. A lot of these UFO occupants seem to, in my sense, look a lot more like just regular human beings than they do the grays. But, you know, having said that, it's not exactly an uncommon form either. And yeah, the origins of that, the particular configuration, you know, large head and large eyes. I mean, I don't really know where we draw the line, because I do believe the people who have seen this firsthand, although it's impossible to not be, you know, contaminated by the media and by that depiction of it. But people have seen this thing, these grays firsthand. But if you go back, you can say, well, okay, Communion, but it's like, no, I'm not, you know, Close Encounters. Okay. So they were influenced by Close Encounters. But then you go back and there are, you know, a few fleeting stories from, you know, the mid 20th century that present something with similar features. Then you can go back to, you know, my argument that I always use is like, well, you can go back to fairy folklore and you can point to, you know, there's a very famous, not very famous, it's very famous in my brain, but a passage from Lewis Spence's 1946 book on fairies in Britain. He talks about fairies having enormous eye sockets and emaciated faces and large and goggling eyes and bony structures and skinny frames. I'm like, okay, so basically a gray, right? And then you've got Lamb from Aleister Crowley, and you go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth until, again, I think you wind up at that ultimate trump card, which is petroglyphs. It's rock art, because you do have, you know, things like on the Sicily Plateau, I believe it is, in Algeria and Australia, that look like gray aliens. And, you know, the ancient astronauts folks will say, aha, you know, this is proof that we've been visited by extraterrestrials. But I'm just like, I think it's more just proof that this form, whatever it is, has been with us for a long time, you know, and maybe a representation of fetal, you know, facial dimensions. But I wonder, when you get back to that sort of time depth of rock art, whether or not the distinction between the imaginal and art and lived experience sort of becomes inconsequential.
In your research, did you come across any instances where multiple people saw the same fictional character, or is it just one person?
For the most, I'm trying to remember. For the most part, I think it was people seeing different things when they saw the same thing. So this is sort of a, you know, I don't want to underscore that. I don't want to understate that. Or sorry, I don't want to overemphasize that, because there are probably some examples of multiple witnesses all reporting the same thing that they're seeing in the book. that they just aren't really jumping to mind. But I think that the more interesting question for me is, you know, do multiple witnesses always see the same thing? And the answer is assuredly no. It's kind of a dirty little secret of ufology and even cryptozoology that people who will both agree that they saw something strange will often disagree on exactly what they saw. You know, I have a friend who's collected stories where, you know, both of them agree that they saw a Bigfoot, but one of them swears that its hair was white and one of them swears that its hair was black. You wind up with this in ufology, in the sense that people will all agree that they saw something in the sky, but some will say it was a disc and some will say it was a triangle, and no, it had red lights. No, it had blue and orange lights. You know, just people will disagree in these different ways. Another story that was from Nottingham in 1966, where these two witnesses agree that they saw something, in Wollaton Park. One of them saw a Bigfoot and the other one saw like this cloudy donut shaped blob hovering there. I think that we are engaged in a dance with this thing, whatever it is, because I can't think of another way to really explain the way that it appears to different people at different times in different ways.
And are there cases where there'll be two people together, somebody will see something and the other person just won't see anything?
Yeah, I mean, and that sort of opens the question as to part. Okay, let me say this. Part of my fourth wall phantom's journey was sort of opening up my mind so much that I just wound up on really unstable ground myself. By which I mean, I get to a certain point towards the end of the book where I'm like, well, I don't really care if story X or Y is true or false, you know, and that's not a great place to be as someone who likes writing books about this topic. Like, you've got to retreat to more conventional spaces. But in that sense, I think we should invite ourselves to engage with the idea that, you know, things like mental illness, of which, you know, someone seeing something that no one else sees, might be something a little bit more objective than we've been led to believe. By which I mean there are therapists who have, rather than medicating their patients with schizophrenia, have encouraged them to engage with and address and talk and reason with the voices in their head, and have had some pretty good results. So, you know, this is sort of the Mircea Eliade question, who, you know, Eliade sort of said, oh, all shamans, you know, very good about being, you know, comparativist, but Eliade said, oh, all shamans are, you know, are epileptics. And it's like, okay, but what does that mean? Like, you know, what does epilepsy signify when you take it out of a materialist, physicalist paradigm? Like, is that something that represents some sort of genuine spirit contact or genuine selection by the spirit world? And so similarly, if someone sees something that no one else sees, is it really there? I don't know. And I don't know. If you look at something like the DSM, you know, sort of the gold standard for determining, you know, mental conditions, a lot of the ways that we differentiate between mental health conditions is through anecdotes, right? It's through firsthand testimony. Like, we can image your brain and say, okay, well, we're seeing some activity in this lobe or that area or this or that. But as far as how it manifests and the sort of feelings that people have about, you know, this condition often manifests in paranoia or in delusions of grandeur, like those sort of things that we see consistently across different diagnoses, those are all determined by asking the patient how they feel. Like, So I think that we really undervalue the role that anecdotes can play in understanding our world.
So we've been talking about your book. It's called Fourth Wall Phantoms, Reflections on the Paranormal, Narrative, and Fictions Becoming Fact. And people can get that on Amazon?
They can. You know, this is the point in the conversation where I also say, you know, visit joshuacutchin.com and we can set up a sale of some books that have been signed by me, but I'm down to two of them. So if you do that, reach out to me and maybe ask first how many I have in stock. But yeah, as long as I have them in stock, I send them and find them and send them to anyone in the domestic US in the lower 48 for no upcharge, just shipping and handling and the cost that you'd find online.
Well, it's been great talking to you. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
It's been really great. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks so much. And I hope to do it again sometime.
That was an interview with Joshua Cutchin about his book, Fourth Wall Phantoms, Reflections on the Paranormal, Narrative, and Fictions Becoming Fact. A great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. When you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue. They are ad-free and released 2 days before the free versions. And if you want to try out the extended episodes, you can now get a 7-day free trial. And please check out my new book. It's called Verified Near-Death Experiences, and it's on Amazon. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.